Welcome to Real Geeks. I am Crash and Burn, and with me, as always, is Mike Montgomery.
Yeah, we finally got around to doing this again. And now, I know we said our next episode was going to be Return to Oz.
Yeah.
Now, we said that, and
we say a lot.
Technically, that is still the plan. It's just, it's still the next episode. Because as much as we've moved away from doing theatrical releases for a fair while now, every once in a while, a movie comes along that is so beautiful, so glorious, so truly entertaining, that we have to scrap everything we said we were going to do, all of our plans, to discuss the wonder, the cinematic brilliance that is Madam Web.
Hey, come on, get your stuff. Let's go. Let's try that again. A week ago, I spent my life racing against time. I'm gonna help you out today, okay? Trying to save people who were running out of it.
Jesse!
Until one moment changed everything.
Come on!
Welcome back to the land that we're living.
I don't understand what's happening. I've been having visions. I knew he was gonna die. I think I'm seeing the future.
New York City's a whole new level of crazy these days.
What do you want from me? What do you want?
New York City's a whole new level of crazy these days.
This is an emergency. Get off the train.
That man's trying to kill you.
What?
Who are you? What is going on?
I can see the future.
Oh, what the hell? She didn't see that coming?
That's not how it works. I've seen that man before.
So who is he?
Ezekiel Sims. He was in the Amazon with my mom when she was researching spiders right before she died.
Wait, I recognize you. You live in my building.
You're the paramedic.
Yeah, you almost ran me over.
You don't think this is weird, how we're all connected?
Honestly, like, the least weird thing that's happened all day.
What do you want from me?
You have no idea what those girls have come.
Why don't you want from me?
I think he can see into the future.
What are you wondering?
He's trying to change what happens. Julia, get down!
Why aren't you scared of me? Why do you care for me?
Your future was almost so different.
Where do we go?
If you want to live, you have to trust me.
Get ready. Now!
You're showing off.
Maybe a little.
Yeah, I for one was actually going to wait until this one entered the Criterion Collection to speak about it, because obviously then it would get the respect it deserves. Such an immense success. Her web connects us all to its shittiness. Good Lord, what a fucking... But like, as you say, like, there's something very special about this. There, like, they released 1,000 shitty films every year. It happens constantly. If we want to talk about just shitty films, we could do that for years worth of podcasts without ever talking about Madam Web necessarily. And as well, typically, if a film is shitty enough, you just don't talk about it. You just kind of like avoid it. You forget it existed. You move on instead of becoming some sort of weird cult that demands that shitty film be released by Netflix or in long form. You know, people get weird, but for the most part, hey, you move on. There's something about this very, very shitty film that is so alluring. And everyone kind of agrees on it. Like, it's like a McCain's Deep and Delicious cake. On no level is that acceptable by any kind of health standard that we have in the modern day. It's subpar in terms of even a flavor profile. And yet, every single Canadian, myself included, will punch their own grandmother to get a goddamn slice of it.
Oh, yeah, and like, personally, to be perfectly frank, I have not had a film make me this happy since things like Geostorm or Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets.
I like Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets.
I love Valerian. It's gloriously stupid.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And I love everything about it.
It's the most, like, overly layered, thin sheet of plot ever. It's magnificent. It's a wedding cake that you can't eat.
It's a McCain Deep and Delicious wedding cake.
Yeah, yeah. and like, so is Madam Web. I would say that if Valerian in the City of a Thousand Planets is one of those microwavable pizzas that come out so goddamn thin, and yet every now and then you get a craving to have one because you're like exhausted to start with, and so you're not thinking straight, but also you're just like, a pizza would be good, and you lie yourself into thinking that this is going to be the same as takeout pizza. That's Valerian in the City of a Thousand Planets, Worlds, whatever. The takeout pizza in that case, of course, being Fifth Element. However, yeah. This is definitely a McCain's Deep and Delicious cake, because there is that icing, that not very good, but we all crave it, icing on the top of it. And it's not very thick, considering the fluffy cake nonsense under it. And that's what most of this film is fluffy cake nonsense. It is sugary crap that your body doesn't really know how to process, but it's covered in some like veneer of almost poo colored chocolate, as all Deep and Delicious cakes should be. and these two things come together to be irresistible and yet irresponsible. So irresponsible.
Like I said to you after your first viewing and my second, Sony, please stop. I'd like another of this movie, but like after that, please stop.
Like, I do and do not want them to stop at Craven, because if Craven is like this, okay, I understand. But if Craven is also like this, God no. There's really no, I know that that's kind of like you're damned if you do, damned if you don't, catch 22 thing, but I don't see any way that Sony can win this, because no matter what they do, they're still releasing that crappy fucking Craven movie. And it's like, can you do better than this? Can you do better, quote unquote, than this? You know, like, there's better and then there's better. Better as in a better fucking film, sure, but better yeah. As in like Venom is technically better than all of this, and Venom's not really a good movie. It's a great performance. It ain't a good movie.
Wait, well, Venom of the Sony Spider-Man films, Spider-Man in air quotes,
we can't say that. Arachnid fella.
Oh, no, we can't. We can't. And thank you so much for that, Disney. Because I've said it before and I will say it again. Like, I love Madam Web with all my heart. However, I don't want Tom Holland anywhere near any of these movies.
No. For his own sake, if not mine.
Yes. The Marvel Spider-Man films are actually Sony films. However, they do continue the trend of the animated Spider-Man films, where the further Sony stays away from them, the better.
Yeah, like, unless it's Sony animated, in which case that department knows what they're doing. But clearly, as with like DC animated's department, they're not talking to the live action people, or the live action people don't want to hear about it. We know how to make movies. Okay.
Oh, no. Apparently, Sony with the animated films has basically taken the approach of, yeah, we don't understand this Into the Spider-Verse thing. Here's money. Just go do what you want with it.
Just go away.
I would like them to do that more.
Oh, God. And so, this in an interesting bit of kismet of like practically no one went to see this film.
Except me.
Yeah, yeah. This was the first time Mike and I have ever actually sat down in the same theater and watched a movie together. Because I know that there were other showings, but I don't think anyone ever showed up to it. The only people in Halifax who went to see Madame Web at all were in that row and the two people behind us. And I'm pretty damn sure that that's like literal, because it's like podcaster, 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 film critic, podcaster, podcaster.
And now I have seen this movie 4 times in theater now.
You're obscene.
Like, I regret nothing. And the audience, when we saw it together, that's the audience every single time I went.
Jesus Christ, that's worse than like when Eddie Burback went to see Venom 5 times. That's because he was doing it for content and clicks and for a joke. You're actually doing it. You're the one stalwart believer. And you dragged the rest of us into it. Everyone else who was in that goddamn row, I suspect you personally reached out to every one of them and said, hey, you want to go see a movie? Because no one fucking told me you would be there. And for just a wonderful moment of hilariosity, why not? When I walked into the theater, it was just Mike there. Now, we have recorded hundreds of episodes, hundreds of episodes. And I walk up to him and I just like crack a joke about, oh, I didn't know you would be here. And he doesn't recognize me. It was magical.
Oh, but it was not that I didn't recognize you. I was looking down photo editing on my iPad, so I never saw you come in.
Well, you should have been used to me just, like, you know, apparating into a fucking room or some shit.
But, yeah, like, it's one fascinating thing with this film is how my first viewing...
Mm-hmm.
There were enough Spider-Man references in about the first half of the movie to get incredibly grating, to the point that, like, I was legitimately angry, just going, please, just stop. Stop.
Yeah.
I know for the fact you can't actually use Spider-Man. Stop pretending.
Yeah, at its worst, this film is grating, specifically because of a couple of elements, but that's one of them, where they shoehorn in another element from Spider-Man, knowing that they can never use Spider-Man, and they're not going to like lie about it or draw it out like Gotham did and then suddenly show you some fucking Spider-Man, be it low budget. They're constantly like laying these little traps, like, of course Uncle Ben is her partner. Oh, he's you know, his sister's having a baby shower. I wonder who that's for.
Yeah.
Oh, your uncle is J. Jonah Jameson, eh? Is he gonna appear in this? Since we know that JJ appears across this, you know, multiverse. No. We're not getting JJ Johnson. We're not getting JK Simmons either. No, nothing. No. Oh. It's just, oh, what's the child's name? Reason not to say it ever on screen. Okay. Then why the fuck are we doing this? It's not cute. It's annoying. We know.
Because we're doing this because then the second half of the movie hits, and by the final act, I'm laughing my ass off every time I see it.
And yes, because it does reduce to absurdity. That's what this film truly does. It boils down the concepts and the expectations into a slurry. So it's all unrecognizable and kind of out of order biologically. And so when you pour this slurry and some alphagetti into a bowl and it all floats together, you start getting bits of the script completely out of place. Or truisms and lines known to Spider-Man, but all fucking jumbled up, you know, in a some sort of like Mad Libs or like thesaurus hunt of how can I say the exact same thing without getting sued, and the entire film is just how can I say the exact same thing without getting sued.
Yeah, and so just to clarify that a little more, I was chatting with an entertainment reporter friend of mine in Ontario about the movie, and I was doing a little research over the course of that, and I think I figured out how the whole licensing thing works. Now, like, Sony does still own the film rights to Spider-Man,
mm-hmm.
but Disney has creative control over that character.
Mm-hmm.
So if I've got this figured out right, anyone that Disney uses, Sony can't.
With clear caveat in the sense of the Vulture cameo?
I think the Vulture cameo was pretty much Disney probably going, yeah, we're not using him anymore. You just take him.
That's fair. Okay. And yeah, that tracks because, of course, we're not seeing any Venom when Null the Deathblade or whatever appeared. It had nothing to do with symbiotes. We're not going to see Kraven or Madam Web or Morbius ever in the MCU. I mean, we might see Morbius once if they manage to somehow get these characters back and there's a Blade project underway again, finally, maybe, in its 100th rewrite. Just have it open with him outright fucking killing Morbius. And it's like, you know, he technically wasn't a vampire, and just have Blade go, I don't give a shit. And that's it. That's just the beginning. That's how Blade starts. And everyone goes, yes, you are the hero we need.
And the one we deserve.
Yay. This is a film that makes you suffer through it a few times via quite a well done segment that they would drop in and out of, where you watch a scene, then it goes back in time to realize that you were just watching a premonition of a scene. Then you watch that scene again, and it goes back in time because you were watching another premonition based on the first premonition of the scene. Then sometimes it goes back again, and then you realize you've been watching a premonition based on a premonition, based on action taken, based on a premonition, based on someone else's premonition that they had in the jungle. And it's just... I like the mechanic. I wish it was done in a better film that I actually enjoyed having to rewatch. But by the third time they did this, I was getting real fucking frustrated that they were eating up screen time with this bullshit that has been established.
That and the simple fact that they take any stakes out of the movie entirely every time you do that.
Yeah.
Because how do you get invested when every time something bad happens, it's, oh, that was a vision. Here, we're gonna do that again.
Yeah, it's entirely based on shocking you and then you seeing how those characters get around that shock. But it's like, the things you're doing are not that shocking to begin with, so it's not having that effect on the audience to start with. And the kind of response from, and there's there is a wonderful bit of performance throughout this entire film. Like, Dakota Johnson gives a performance that is brilliantly aware of itself, and you can't help but wonder what her next line read is going to be like, because it is so intentionally god awful. Yeah.
Like, I have seen a lot of critics talking about how bad Dakota Johnson is in the movie, and I'm kind of sitting there looking at the material that she has to work with, and I can't help but think, what was she supposed to do?
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's clearly supposed to be, the way that these scenes are written, like, first you have the shock, then you have the figuring it out, then you have the successful reliving of it. Yeah, you know, we've all seen Edge of Tomorrow. Well, we should have all seen Edge of Tomorrow. If you haven't seen it, it's great. But there's, we've seen this be done before. We've seen Tom Cruise, who is a fantastic actor, but also tends to, like, get really handsy with the script first to make sure that it's worth performing in. He plays a character who is constantly reliving the same military operation due to hijinks with an alien. And his frustration is real. His entertainment, whenever he, like, finds ways to have a little fun or get the upper hand on other people is real. His success after trial and error really, like, you feel it, and it's earned. And none of that emotional depth, none of that success comes through in this. But instead of, like, oh, this is just a failed performance, it's like sticking Leslie Nielsen into this movie without changing the script whatsoever, and just having him deadpan all of the lines and react completely normally to every single event, regardless of how over the top it is. That's what she's given us. That's what Dakota Johnson has given us, a completely benign line reading to every single situation. And it takes what should be a complete calamity, a clusterfuck of epic proportions, and makes it a farce about itself.
I mean, now, first and foremost, listeners like myself, you probably just imagined Leslie Nielsen saying the line, "I just want to go home and watch Idol." And like me, you probably really want that movie.
Yeah, I just want to go home and watch Idol.
But number two, like, Dakota Johnson is trying, but she is woefully miscast. I'm not saying that she's a bad actress or anything, just completely wrong for the role of trying to play what is a supporting character in everything ever.
Yeah, like, that is the worst.
As a lead.
That is the worst old age makeup I've ever seen. This character's supposed to be in her 80s? What the fuck kind of skin cream is she using? Like, they made major changes, obviously. Like, anyone who has ever seen or heard of Madame Web before this film, probably in the 1990s cartoon, of course.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
She annoyed the fuck out of me. You know, there's just a couple of very basic things that come with, like, that character. One, she lives in some far out trippy whatever the fuck dimension. I don't know. It's a nexus point. It's inside Peter's head. It's the magical land of make-believe. I don't fucking know. Two, she is old as dirt. Old. She's actually based on, if I recall, is it Stanley or Jack Kirby's wife? I want to say Jack Kirby.
I don't know about specifically based on, but in the cartoon, she was voiced by Stanley's wife.
Okay, and I truly believe based on as well, at some point.
I can see it.
Yeah. Three, she's paralyzed from, I believe, the waist down. She can move her arms. Yes. And four, finally, she is blind. And so this movie obviously is like, it's an origin story. Sure. All right. By the end of it, yes, she is paralyzed. Yes, she is blind. It is the most tacked on incident entirely, to the point that when it happens, you actually have to think about it for a moment and go, okay. I thought we were just going to forget about that element. But she's in her like late 20s. I get that by the time the wee baby Parker who was born in this movie grows up to be Spider-Man, she'll be older, but like she's going to be in her mid 40s. What, you're kind of a dickhead, Parker, if you think she's like some old decrepit lady. And like what the hell is going on? I understand you want her to be hot so that you can sell the movie tickets. Somewhat attractive of young, whatever. You have Sydney Sweeney for the rest of them.
We're gonna talk about her.
Yeah, we're gonna talk about that. But it's so badly handled in terms of just rushing a film out, casting whoever the fuck you want or can grab, I guess. Like, no one was lining up for this film to be in it. You can't tell me that the guy they cast as Sims was like, hey, you know who I've always wanted to play? That character that appeared for like 5 issues maximum way back during the goddamn Clone Saga?
Wait, was Ezekiel Sims really that far back?
If not, I hate Spider-Man, so don't ask me.
Because I thought he was introduced in the Spider Totems storyline a few years ago.
Then probably
that. Which is what this is based on.
Which I hate. I hate the Spider Totem storyline. I could just barely stand it when they did it for Batman. And I love Grant Morrison, but like making these characters whose base tragedy and raison d'etre is so directly personal and because of their own inactions or perceived inactions, turning those into these grander mystical things where they're fated to have to deal with this crap just robs everything. Doing it with Batman, one single character, and of course, you know, the entire Wayne family, that's bad enough because it really reduces one man's war against crime into this just silly fucking prophesied crap going back to the dawn of history. Doing it with Spider-Man and then going, but there's also so many of them. There's an entire tribe and you're a Spider-Man and you're a Spider-Man and you're a Spider-Man. Like, and that's not, to be very clear, that is not the multiverse. Multiverse of Spider-Man, that makes sense. Every universe has a different Spider-Man. Cool, cool, cool. That organization is entirely sexual. God, that organization is entirely, oh God, I've lost the word, you know, secular. There, that organization is entirely secular. It has nothing to do with greater spiritual whatever. I hate spider totems. I hate those vampires that eat spider totems. I think that whole thing is the dumbest goddamn crap ever. Give me back fucking Doc Ock in Spidey's body. That's good Spider-Man.
I hated that one too, but it's still better. Also, I should know we're at nearly at a half an hour and we haven't even mentioned the plot.
Don't need to. Like, okay. All right. Mike wants to know about the plot of the film he's seen 4 times. So there's this EMT. So there's this EMT, right? And she works with Ben Parker. You've heard of Ben, right? Yeah, irresponsible. And she dies. But the movie doesn't end. It should, but it doesn't. Or maybe we're in some hallucination she's having. That actually, that makes a lot more sense. She's dying. and the entire film and all its goddamn ridiculousness that has nothing to do with her life whatsoever occurs in her brain slowly shutting down. Anyway, she dies, but she gets superpowers, you know, like that much better movie, Dead Zone. And it's much better TV remake, The Dead Zone.
Amen.
I really, really wish Stephen King was like a little more litigious on shit. Because like, if he saw this, he'd be, that sounds familiar. Anyway, and she thinks that she's going nuts. I think she's going nuts. We all think we're going nuts. Why'd we pay money to watch this movie? And she's going about her life, and suddenly she runs into the plot, which involves a guy who knew her mother and murdered her, thus forcing her own early birth in a ritualistic fashion in the middle of Peru by a spider cult who all dress like mesh t-shirt Tobey Maguire. He's here to murder some unrelated girls who all have had annoying interactions of one way, one form or another with Dakota Johnson. Awkward, horrible interactions. If we're supposed to root for these characters or recognize them in any kind of positive way, gosh, this film doesn't know how to do that.
Now, just to add to that point right there, I would like to point out the fact that we have heroes who are annoying, awkward, and pretty much unrelatable in any way. Mm-hmm. And then we have a villain with a clear-cut motivation of, I don't want to die.
Yes.
Who are you rooting for?
Yeah. His motivation is so shallow because it literally is, I don't want to die. I have had a premonition too, and it is that these three costume idiots are going to kill me one day. Never really asking why three superheroes would kill you. I think that would raise some questions. Am I going to become a supervillain? Perhaps I can avoid this supervillainy. Perhaps I can roll harder with my supervillainy and make sure that someone kills them when they come for me. No, no. He decides I have to track them down here in the past using Advanced Patriot Act science. and then kill them himself with his bare hands. Mostly through strangulation and venom through his hands, which, like, interesting approach, but mostly just creates a villain who constantly throttles women. This film has a very specific image in mind when it comes to violence against women. Yeah. And it repeats it and repeats it and repeats it and repeats it, but it never says anything about it. So I feel like at some earlier version of the script, there was kind of like a violence against women aspect to this. Whereas like, it's all there. It's a guy trying to kill a bunch of women, but there's no message. It's fascinating.
No. But I'll just to add to that. So at one point early in the movie, Ezekiel Sims gets this technology by meeting an NSA agent at an opera, taking her back to his place, seducing her, and then using his poison to paralyze her to get her password so that he can get NSA access.
Hmm.
Which, in and of itself, okay, fine. Here's the thing. When he paralyzes her, he specifically says, and give me your password before my poison reaches your lips and you can't speak anymore. I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
We watch the poison reach her vocal cords.
Yes.
How is she still speaking? I don't give a shit about her lips.
Because it looks better on camera. And speaking about speaking and Ezekiel... boy, those are some
different line readings,
aren't they? ADR working overtime. I really do hope someone literally worked overtime on all that. I hope you got paid. because holy shit, easily half of all of his lines are different. Easily half, and not well covered up necessarily or used in the right spot. It's like watching an edit, like a localization of a video game from Japan with a lot of dialogue. And eventually they give up. You know, it doesn't matter if the character has stopped talking on screen and left the scene. The audio is still going because it has to.
Yeah.
It has to. And this film has legendarily had so many script changes, even during shooting, like major script changes during shooting. Literally half of the villain's lines, and the villain, again, is the driving principle in this film. The film is only occurring because this villain has a very specific agenda and is acting towards it. Our hero is entirely passive. Entirely passive. She reacts when she is shown what could happen, but in the primary reality she is inhabiting until that premonition, she's not doing shit. She has nothing to do with any of it. She actually has nothing to do with any of it. She inserts herself into a story that is already in process, in progress. And so he's the driving force, well, therefore he's the driving narrative, but so much of his narrative is literally changed that the entire film's plot just becomes this jumble of whatever the fuck we need him to say. God damn it.
And, well, I'm going to take that passivity a little further, because does she insert herself or does she get inserted?
If she had left that subway train the second she realized she was, like, reliving Worf's day or some shit, no problem. I'm not seeing anyone dying. I'm not seeing anything happen. I left the train. Hey, you know, I see myself getting a hot dog from that vendor.
I mean, well, like, let's be honest. The fact that those spontaneous visions of hers, spontaneous plot devices of hers, let's not kid ourselves here, pretty much pull her into the plot, whether she wants to or not.
Well, there's the thing. She does always have the choice. It's not like circumstances are pushing her into the plot. She sees what happens and she does have the option to not involve herself. But of course, you know, like, that's part of why they made her an EMT, so that when she involves herself, it's like, oh, yeah. It's just, you know, it's part of her personality. It's how she reacts to stuff, all of that. But this is not her story. Her web may connect us all, but she's not in it.
She should not be, for multiple reasons, because there is one element of this movie that I don't know if you caught this. I literally did not catch this until my fourth viewing, and I have not heard anyone discuss this. So as we mentioned, the movie opens in the jungles of Peru, furthering the trend started in Morbius that if you are researching animals in a remote jungle location, you will die.
Yes.
And Ezekiel is her Constance Webb's security. And his plan is to steal the spider for himself so that he can get spider powers. Because the moment in this movie where I went, oh, sweet Jesus, is when we see in Constance's notes where it actually says, a bite from this spider gives you superpowers.
Yeah. And it's one of those really weird things, because until you know, like, I had read about that, but until you literally see that, you're like, why did he kill her? For the spider? Why the fuck would he want a spider?
Yeah. Now, not only that, but eventually she comes back announcing she's found the spider. Ezekiel shoots everyone there and then struggles with her over the spider. And as they're struggling, the gun goes off. What I noticed on my fourth viewing, the gun is pointing downward.
Ah.
It is pointing at the womb. Cassie should have been dead before she was born.
Now, here's the real question. Is this a technical mistake or is this a dropped plot line? Make your choice. Incompetence or failure? Failure or incompetence?
And I mean, so much of this script is just roll the dice anyway. And as much as I refuse to call out Dakota Johnson for any of the problems with this movie, the two people that I will call out are Matt Sazma and Burke Sharpless, who are responsible for the story and in large part responsible for the screenplay. Now, there's Claire Parker and director S.J. Clarkson, who are also credited for the screenplay. In Claire Parker's case, this seems to be her first screenplay, so her I will cut a little slack.
Yeah. Everyone makes now, some crap sometimes.
As for Sazma and Sharpless, let me read their writer credits on IMDb. Dracula Untold,
mm-hmm.
The Last Witch Hunter,
mm-hmm.
Gods of Egypt,
mm-hmm.
Power Rangers, which
mm-hmm.
cinematically is the best credit they have, Morbius,
mm-hmm.
and of course, Madame Web.
All bangers, I see no problem.
Exactly.
I do have a soft spot for Dracula Untold, but it is crap.
Oh yeah, like you look at this credit list, I'm going, how did you get hired?
How have you stay hired?
And
how has this occurred again and again and again and again?
And my immediate second thought is, well, I mean, okay, yeah, it is Sony.
At some point, we do have to do Gods of Egypt because it, unfortunately for all involved, like including himself, to have this on his IMDb and never be able to do something about it. Chadwick Boseman does a really interesting performance in that film. And it's like, what are you doing here? Why are you here? You have better things to do. You had such a short life. Why did you waste some of it on this fucking picture? You could have been making so much better stuff. God damn it.
Yeah, and also, one of my favorite things in bad movies is where they bring the film to a screeching halt to pontificate about something or to educate about something. And Madame Web really has a fixation on CPR. It doesn't know how to do CPR.
See, yeah, that's the real fun of it, isn't it? Is that it again and again repeats how to perform CPR and really puts some time and effort into it. And yet it's not right. It's not right even by the standard of the time of like 2002, 2003 when the film is set. It's really bizarre to spend that much time on something and not get it right. And like that, it's repeated a few times and is clearly central to the character as an EMT. It's likely that it was in the script from a very early point. So various people have workshopped this. They would have had like even medics on set watching them film this, that could have been like,
yeah,
that's not right.
No,
don't do that.
I mean, like, I know I said to you, I think, while we were chatting after the movie, that like I've taken first aid enough times to know that, yeah, you're not even completely teaching it.
just break the rib.
And they even have Celeste O'Connor's Maddie Franklin go, you know, I've never said this in my life, but you're actually a good teacher.
And it not only feels unearned for that very obvious, clear reason, this is at a point that, like, relatively still early in their relationship as a group. And it's like, no, you're supposed to still be snide and shit. Where did this honest, like, approval come from? And it's, again, rewrites. That version of the character is from an earlier version of the script, because this scene with CPR, for some fucking reason, has survived, you know, like a dinosaur trapped underground, finally coming out millions of years later. The CPR scenes are Godzilla.
Like, I swear, when I say the movie comes to a dead stop so that they can do this, I swear you could actually hear tires squealing in the theater.
Yeah, and like, here's the thing. They could have had a reason for this coming up again and again and again. It would have been very straightforward. Our main character has visions of the future. Give her a vision of the future where she sees herself die and need, you know, CPR. So she has to teach it to every one of them, because she has different scenarios in her head about how it happens and which one is unavailable. But if she teaches it to all of them, she should be all right. And then have that get upset somehow. But that's why it becomes like this necessary focus of why she keeps bringing it back up and why it keeps reoccurring. I don't understand how a film has this many rewrites and is about the web that connects everything, and everything's just a scene occurring one after another, practically unconnected to the previous scene, like an episode of fucking Riverdale.
Oh, they demonstrate early on they're not doing callbacks to anything.
Nothing matters. Everything's important until it blows up. The only thing that is important in this is Pepsi Cola product placement. I love the way she held that can at the
barbecue.
At the barbecue slash baby shower, where it's like, okay, I have to hold this can label out for product placement. Okay, I'll hold this can out label front for product placement as fucking awkwardly as I can. I feel like there's 100 shots for every scene in this. There's 100 takes for every scene in this movie, because she just wouldn't do what they wanted. And what we got is the closest.
Yeah,
so you know that there's some really obnoxious shit out there. She's just holding the can up to camera and intentionally blocking everyone. Is this right? Is this what you want?
And like, going along with that, there is also a fair bit of, yeah, that's not how people talk. That's not how people act. Now, she has the she's given the can of Pepsi that, again, clearly just product placement, mm-hmm. and has the line that basically, I just died. Don't you think I'm entitled to a beer? Any sane person and any partner at work, fellow EMT, what, like, literally any relationship justification you want to use, mm-hmm. would have offered her a beer in that scenario, and I will not be told otherwise.
Yeah, and what we learned from this is Ben Parker is kind of a dick in a really, like, he cares about you kind of way, so you can't even get really upset at him, but let's face it, he's a dick.
Yes, he's almost fascinating, because it's like in this movie, in some ways, he's almost kind of Ned Flanders-ish without the church.
Yeah. Yeah. He is better than you, but also he's judging you for it. And you're just like, oh, fuck off, man.
You can almost kind of see him, his character, becoming the Martin Short Uncle Ben from The Amazing Spider-Man.
Oh my god.
Like, I could do a better job of connecting Madam Web to the actual Spider-Man movies than Sony could ever hope to.
It's just such a Oh, this film is a clusterfuck. Jesus Christ.
But also with the lack of callbacks. So we have the big subway confrontation where they escape Ezekiel Sims the first time. And Cassie steals a cab and then holds onto it for far longer than she should have been able to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Just by removing the license plates, which should have made the cab more suspicious, but anyway.
Right. You know, it's a cab. Oh, a cab in New York. We'll never find it. It doesn't have any license plates. Now, that's a thing that people will notice.
You would think. But, and again, hold on to that thought, because we're going to get right back to the whole people not noticing things.
Mm.
So they hear over the radio witnesses describing like the incident and how now Cassie is wanted for kidnapping and also possibly an attack on multiple NYPD officers. They specifically have the line that how did no one see what they refer to as ceiling guy, which is Ezekiel Sims as the Brightburn version of Spider-Man.
Yes.
My theory is this. No matter the franchise in the Sony universe, every extra, every minor character has the mentality of a mob informant and didn't see a goddamn thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No one else exists except for the main players in any scene. Everything else is like literally NPCs. We're not getting the rich texture of the background players that you had in the original Sony Spider Sam Raimi movies, where like any random New Yorker could be a character and you immediately through just a couple of lines got a clear idea of who that person is and what they stand for. You know, like that guy who yells, you know, you mess with one of us, you mess with all of us. You have an idea from the accent, the outfit he's wearing, the fact that he's saying this to a lunatic on a flying fucking like glider dressed like a Power Ranger. You know, there's so much character invested and it becomes this rich city of active people who very much will tell you, oh, yeah, I fucking saw Spider-Man. I sure did. And these films, you have so much ridiculous thing, so many ridiculous things occurring in them. All the Venom films, Morbius, Madam Web, the other Venom film. I'm sure there's another one in there that I have just intentionally forgotten, but if not, my God, the damage they have done in so few films. Huh. There's only ever the main characters. Everything else just pops in and out of existence in a fever dream.
Now, just to add to this, we're going to go to the trailer for Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, where Walter Peck, in a voiceover, specifically says that 40 years ago, the Ghostbusters had claimed to do all these things and capture all these ghosts. There were no eyewitnesses.
What the fuck?
Where, and we have seen the Ghostbusters tackle ghosts in front of the entire city of New York.
Twice.
Exactly.
I mean, like, there were no eyewitnesses, and I seem to remember him getting creamed on. You were there, you dickless asshole.
He was there, but in the Sony metaverse of film, there is no such thing as the concept of an eyewitness.
Yeah, yeah. No one saw anything. It was amazing looking. We spent so much money on the effects. It's a shame no one saw it.
The list of eyewitnesses and audience for this movie are exactly the same.
And I'm trying to forget. So yeah, she kidnaps the kids and drives them out into the middle of the woods because 5 minutes outside of Manhattan is the woods, and 5 minutes after that is Alberta.
Sony backlot woods, but
yeah. Anyway, that's how it tends to work in Fox movies, and I'm gonna say that's how it works in Sony movies as well. Five minutes, Alberta. It's the Chris Claremont rule. Don't worry about it. And so they find a diner, and the girls start dancing on the table for a bunch of teen boys.
Quick note before the diner, because
yeah.
I have problems with the diner. That is a rant in and of itself.
It definitely is horrible.
To go back to the, we're officially doing more callbacks than this movie did.
Yeah.
But just after Cassie leaves, three teenage girls in the forest.
Yes. With some jerky.
With a few pieces of glove box jerky and a superpowered psychopath trying to kill them. But no, they'll be fine by themselves.
Yeah.
Sydney Sweeney's Julia Cornwall, and also a quick side note, if anyone does not know, that is Julia Carpenter's maiden name. She specifically has the line that she knows Taekwondo.
Mm-hmm.
Not only is this never, ever brought up again, especially during the final act where there are multiple points where they could have done something with that.
Yeah.
Sydney Sweeney herself actually is trained in mixed martial arts.
And they didn't use it. And yeah, her
nope.
Her Spider-Woman isn't even known for that. She has some sort of mystical web powers as shown in the movie
psychic. It's psychic, like, webbing.
It doesn't have anything to do with anything. It's fantastic. Nope. I love it. Anyway, they bond, they bicker, they bond, they go and find a diner. They end up listening to Toxic comes on again before it was actually released.
We're going to the needle drop before Toxic.
Oh god.
So they get to this diner and this particular song comes on. Now the song is called Scandalous by an artist called Mystique. The first time that I saw this scene, my first thought was, why are you doing a needle drop here?
Hmm.
My second thought was that I recognized the song and immediately went, oh no.
I don't know it. Yay.
Because that particular song is a tad infamous. Because not only was it first released in the Halle Berry Catwoman.
Oh.
It is linked to the basketball scene in Halle Berry's Catwoman.
See, I have never seen that. The single
most
ever.
Infamous worst scene in that entire movie. And you're connecting yourself to that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Willingly and then forgetfully, because it has nothing to do with the scene. It has nothing to do with what follows in the scene. It has nothing to do with what follows after that scene. So yeah, that happened. Random needle drop. That is clearly a callback, but a horrible one to do. Then they start, Toxic comes on. And yes, as everyone has said, yes, Toxic was released after this film was set. I feel like that's a minor thing when we're looking at the overall fuckery of this film. However, it's a necessary point.
It was, if I remember right, the album was released, I think, in December of 2003.
Yeah.
The single was early 2004, so there's no way it should be coming on the radio in this scene.
Yeah.
But, again, minor detail.
Yeah. What is really curious about this scene, though, is you feel like it's leading in a completely different direction because of like context and awareness of how plots work and say how certain kind of characters are usually written, and it just abandons it. So they start dancing on the table for a bunch of teenage boys. They don't know these teenage boys. These are the teenage boys of the town. And it goes perfectly fine. So what the fuck was the point of it? And I know what the fuck the point of it was. It was all the upskirt shots of Sydney Sweeney. However, again, where the, like, this is a film that mostly stars women. All, you know, the major characters are women. The antagonist is a violent man who wants to kill those women. This is a moment that in a film that was actually trying to say something about violence against women would have used that moment to show how dangerous that fucking situation was for those teenage girls. And instead, Ezekiel Sims drives a car through the, or no, Ezekiel Sims comes through the front door, and then our heroine, Madame Webb, drives a car through the front door through him. And the scene ends with her doing some Terminator shit. But like, what the fuck was the point of any of that?
You want to see me make it worse?
No.
Now, they spontaneously start dancing on the table. And now, we're going to ignore the fact that there is no way in hell the manager of this diner would not have immediately kicked them out.
Maybe it's a Waffle House.
I just feel like having this start because the song starts playing and Maddie Franklin, the black member of the group, immediately just gets overcome by the music,
mm-hmm,
and just has to get on the table and start dancing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you watch that and not go,
Like, this is a film that it feels like it probably should have come out in the era it was set, because it's not good to make those kinds of assumptions with characters, but they did back then an awful lot. And so it feels so dated. Everything about it feels so dated that it's like,
yeah,
this entire film should be a warning of like, whatever situation these characters get themselves into, don't do what they did, and don't do what they did to lead up to it. These are bad decisions.
Oh, and bad decisions made by stereotypical Hollywood caricatures of teenagers.
Yeah.
Not actual teenagers, because teenagers, I'm pretty sure, can make it at least an hour before they decide they need to wander off and go find food.
It's such a lazy film. Okay, so from there, I honestly blank on what happens next until they end up on top of, or no, until they end up setting the trap at the fireworks factory. It all leads to the fireworks factory.
Here's what happens next.
Oh, Lordy.
So Cassie has the big cab rescue that they drive off. Cassie tears a strip off all three girls in the cab. And I mean, let's be honest, rightfully so. They get to the hotel. I believe it's Cassie has a vision where it's another one of those. It starts where they don't tell you that it's a vision, but then the mechanic changes. And it's an exchange between Cassie and Sims where it's the only point where the mechanics of Cassie's vision powers actually make sense, because you at least realize it's a vision. And then comes the CPR lesson.
Of course.
And then they figure out that Ezekiel was connected to Cassie's mom.
Ah, right. And then she goes to Peru.
And she abandons the three girls again.
Well, also, to be clear, wanted for kidnapping.
Oh, yeah. Wanted for kidnapping. 2 years post 9/11, mm-hmm. successfully gets onto an international flight at, I'm assuming, JFK.
Yeah. Yeah. And then gets
back into
the
country. It doesn't matter because none of this should be possible, but.
Yeah. Yeah. It's if you didn't live through it, you don't understand how stupid that was. So she gets down there. She meets the tribe that she is apparently a member of because she was born in their sacred grotto. Sure. All right. I guess. Sure. It if this film wants to claim an indigenous identity, I guess there are other crimes to add to that list along with it. Sure. All right. Do whatever you'd like to do.
And I would just ask, can we give this tribe a better name?
No, as lazy as possible. Be happy we didn't call them Los Spitos or some shit. Los Spideros. Los Spitos Manos.
They literally, now I admit that my Spanish or any related dialect is not the greatest. Mm-hmm. But I'm pretty sure they did just call this tribe the Spiders.
More or less, yes. Like, you know, they used the word arachnid or arachno or arachnia or whatever. They tried. They found a synonym. They found a synonym. That's what this movie's about. Finding synonyms. Opening that thesaurus. Change those words as little as legally necessary. And yeah, so the Spider-Men, wink, hoink, let her know that, oh no, we have spider powers, you have spider powers, everyone's capable of having spider powers, and we're all one big spider in a web, and you're in the middle of the web, and don't ask why. Just don't ask why. It's fine.
No, he straight up Doctor Stranges her.
Yeah.
Which, in and of itself, was kind of that amazing, why?
Because but, we can.
Which sends Cassie back to essentially showing her the start of the movie. And then she spontaneously goes further back where her mother receives the diagnosis of... I need...
Plot character device.
While Cassie is still in the womb, we go to a vision of her mother, meaning I'm going to say her OBGYN because I don't know better, but that makes sense, where she receives the diagnosis of myasthenia gravis. Here's the thing. Myasthenia gravis cannot be diagnosed before birth. It is not a genetic condition, but an autoimmune disorder. Now, apparently there is also another entry on IMDb that claims the disease can be transmitted genetically. So, look, even the IMDb goofs are probably a little fucked up.
I mean, listen, they put in the effort to actually come up with a disease, which is better than Morbius did. So, eh.
That's true. That's fair. That's not my problem with this scene. That whole thing plays out. Cassie realizes that she made this trip to Peru in the struggle to find a cure for Cassie. Should be a beautiful moment. And then Cassie starts physically interacting with the vision, mm-hmm. speaking to her mother and hugging her mother, things that never happened and she should therefore not be seeing.
To which, you know, again, as I said, she's dying. All of this is in her head. It's getting weirder because she has fewer brain cells.
I mean, that works because we've already established Cassie has died so many times in this movie that Stephen Moffat may as well have been writing it. I mean, okay, automatically it would have been better, but still.
Yeah.
The man has a thing for character death. But she comes back and chats with good old Santiago, who apparently in the roughly 25, 30 years between Cassie's birth and Cassie's return to the grotto. The Peruvian jungle has apparently gotten an American eagle because, man, has Santiago's wardrobe changed.
I mean, you know, like, there's stuff you do when there's tourists around, and there's stuff you do when, you know, there aren't tourists around. It wasn't the right season.
And I bring all this up because this is the point where we get what it may have been the single most beautiful and most mocked line connected to this movie, but has the distinction of actually being in this movie.
Hmm.
When you accept the responsibility, great power will come. And so help me, I'm getting that line on a t-shirt.
It's the great...
It's just... Mwah.
It's the great mishmash. It doesn't actually mean what the original phrase "with great power comes great responsibility" means. It's almost like some kind of scary promise of power! You know, if you promise to play nice. If you promise to play nice, you will have power! Instead of, you know, like, if you have power, maybe you should not be a dick about it. But Sony not getting that right, not fundamentally understanding it, that's just so this entire series. So it kind of really fits. It's like their motto, their business mantra for this entire project. And it's a complete clusterfuck. And of course, what do you expect out of it? They rush back to New York for the conclusion of the film. Which again, as Milhouse has so often demanded, when are they going to get to the fireworks factory?
When are they going to get to the fireworks factory?
Well, I mean, but before the fireworks factory, we need to watch Ezekiel almost kill Ben, Mary, and the girls and the unborn Peter Parker, because apparently a fair bit of this is still that famous first draft that is a Terminator ripoff.
Which, God, that would have been at least something. And that's why, like, moments like her driving into the diner, yeah, it's an obvious Terminator ripoff. That kind of had a point once upon a time. And what is Terminator kind of about? Unstoppable violence by a man against a woman. These themes are present in that, and they should be in this, and everything's there, but there's no awareness. There's no self-awareness of its own message implicit in the entire film. And so instead it just becomes, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then he did that, and then he did that.
And what he did, this being Ezekiel, was instead of killing these supporting characters and accomplishing his goal, when Cassie drives a stolen ambulance, because to go back to the dying brain cells theory, Grand Theft Auto logic applies,
mm-hmm.
She comes crashing through a billboard and slams the ambulance into him, which should be a great badass moment, except for the fact that he has to jump 20 feet in the air to get in front of the ambulance for her to do this.
Yeah. Yeah, that scene is really badly fucking set up. It's just really,
again,
really bad.
Should be a great moment. Should be a great moment. But you're still sitting there going, questions.
The geography of the entire scene makes no goddamn sense whatsoever.
And now we can get to the fireworks factory. Which I'm going to open with a Star Trek V inspired, truly immortal question. Why does an ambulance have a smoke grenade?
There are times I could see an ambulance needing a smoke grenade. In the middle of Manhattan, I do not believe that would necessarily be standard issue.
Like,
5 minutes outside of Manhattan in the forest? Yeah.
Like, the flares I understood. The use of a defibrillator to shock Ezekiel off of the roof of the ambulance, I understood. The fact that Cassie refers to it as an AED, I did not, but fuck it. Now we get inside the fireworks factory, and this has to be the point where the writers, director, cast, film crew all just went, fuck it, let's have some fun.
Yeah, and you can tell, and it is kind of a fun scene. There's stuff exploding, and there's fun interactions based on using precognition tactically. Something actually occurs in this scene.
Yep.
Holy shit. I didn't think that that was possible in this movie, especially not this far in where I had given up.
I mean, okay, yes, apparently fireworks are suddenly the equivalent of surface-to-surface or surface-to-air missiles, but again, fuck it!
Fuck it. Fuck it. I'd like to see where there actually is, like, a fireworks factory or warehouse in New York. Like, no, I'm sorry. There's no way they're allowed to store that much shit in modern New York in the city. It's like, come the fuck on. And it's like, it's a place that already caught on fire and they still have fucking fireworks in there. That is delightful. Anyway.
I mean, if there had been still like crime scene or whatever form of no entry tape, they would have been used around the building.
Yeah.
Because the fire has just happened, then I could understand it. I mean, with that earlier fire, I love the fact that you have an ambulance get T-boned by a dump truck, and then two scenes later, they demonstrate that there was absolutely no reason for this to happen beyond plot convenience.
Mm-hmm.
Again, mm-hmm. Wow.
Oh, yeah.
But I digress.
So Ezekiel chases the girls to the conclusion that we already know is going to happen because we saw it in a vision on the rooftop. With a helicopter, a collapsing Pepsi Cola, drink Pepsi Cola sign, and an exploding factory. And what happens is just... So when Madame Webb was off having her little vacation in Peru, she discovered the power of being able to, like, leave her body and kind of project anywhere she needs to be multiple times if necessary, and be able to do stuff with that projection. And that finally comes through as she saves the girls, as they each have their own little brush with death in this mousetrap-like fucking plot conundrum on top of the roof.
And I mean, I'm pretty sure that when you are astral projecting, you cannot actually interact with the physical world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But again, fuck it.
Fuck it. Fuck it. The movie is so close to being done, it doesn't care anymore. And really, as an audience member, nor should you. And she beats the bad guy by dropping a PepsiCo, a drink Pepsi Cola, fucking sign, the infrastructure of the sign on him.
Oh, no. She beats the bad guy by leading him toward this Pepsi Cola sign and looking back up at it so many times that she might as well be telling him what she's going to do. His precognitive powers be damned.
Yeah, which again, he only has one vision. He only has one precognitive vision that never changes based on circumstance whatsoever. Whereas she goes to get a cola down the fucking street at the convenience store and she's paralyzed by an infinite multiverse.
Which, and the pièce de résistance there for me in that moment was when she tells him, you were so focused on those girls that you didn't see they were not what led to your end. I am, or words to that effect. What was he supposed to see? Because there is no indication of Cassie Webb in his vision anywhere.
Yeah, once again, she is not involved in the actual plot of this movie. She has been shoehorned in, but as far as he knew, up to including that morning after probably having another fucking night of nightmares, reliving the same vision, she has nothing to do with his death. It's these three girls. He has no indication whatsoever that this fight in a fireworks factory is going to be how he dies. He should be the one constantly having visions of the fucking Pepsi Cola sign and be like, I don't know what that means. Maybe I've been watching too many commercials. Maybe I need to knock it off on the Coke or some shit. It has nothing to do with her. It has everything to do with him. And he's yep. now uninvolved in his own fate. Why?
The entire Ezekiel Sims storyline in this movie is a destiny trap.
Yes.
Start to finish. By trying to prevent his death, he causes it.
Yeah, but a destiny trap is supposed to be a mistake of perspective. You should have the exact same scenario work out, but in a way he didn't anticipate. Not an entirely different scenario years earlier with someone else. That's not a destiny trap. That's just fucking up.
Yeah, and I, again, as much as I had issues with his run on Doctor Who, where the hell is Stephen Moffat when we need him?
anyway, so he gets crushed by happenstance and fate and stupidity and product placement. Don't forget product placement. She gets thrown into the Hudson, which is bad enough. And then, because the film remembers, oh, fuck, right. She needs to be blind and paralyzed. A flaming piece of debris strikes her right in the face. And can I just say that it is the funniest moment ever? Because it's like the film's writer, like their hand reaches into the script and cruelly, coldly, and in the funniest way possible, just flicks a piece of flaming metal into her face. And that's it, just bonk. And that's it. It's just, that was the greatest comedic moment ever that you don't expect at all. You think, okay, she's gonna die and then she's gonna wake up again and maybe this whole thing has been a vision and she's like, all right, let's do that right this time, and then it goes to credits, or the girls jump in and save her, or Ben Parker jumps in and saves her. A couple of different things could have occurred. No, flaming wreckage to the face and then she wakes up in hospital.
We've been watching her dodge fireworks for about the last 10-15 minutes. So we're going to have one conveniently smack her right in the face, because, again, like you said, the writers immediately went, oh, right. And I'm sorry, this moment is the equivalent of the guy bouncing off the propeller in Titanic.
Yeah, yeah. It's it's so random and just like it didn't have anything to do, again, with any visions whatsoever. There wasn't.
Nope.
There wasn't that aspect. The product placement Coca-Cola sign, lots of times. This flaming piece of metal that will blind and paralyze her? Nah. She doesn't need to know that.
Julia dives in to rescue her, pulls her out of the water. We get another CPR scene that is so checklist that it is one last, people don't talk like this.
Yes.
And then we get to the hospital where, by the end of this, I'm pretty sure multiple adoption-related laws have been broken.
As well.
We do technically get a Peter Parker cameo and some of the hokiest dialogue you have ever heard. And in this movie, that's saying something.
Yeah, yeah. And I personally want Disney to sue them over that. And it's like, no, we know who that baby is. Come the fuck on.
And the movie ends with a final bit of a jump forward where we need to get Cassie into the chair. So we get her into the chair.
Yeah.
We need to demonstrate that she now has control of her precognitive powers. So we get that.
So she becomes insufferable to live with. And then, of course, you know, the glasses, the red glasses. You got to throw on the red glasses. And it's not the glasses. It's not the chair. It's her fucking smirk that she has the entire time from the moment she wakes up from her coma. Just this endless fucking smirk. And it's because she knows that the movie's almost over.
And it's implied that she is the foster mother to these three girls whose parents, as far as we know, are all still alive. But again, fuck it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And a final moment where we pan up an apartment building from the second Tobey Maguire movie. This movie is so in-house that that building actually is from that movie. To a final shot of everyone in costume, where apparently Dakota Johnson has been replaced by Anne Hathaway.
Yes. Literally, if you cover up half of her face, she becomes Anne Hathaway, and it's really fascinating to see. You don't expect it. But yeah, she's floating there, astrally projecting behind the girls, who are now in their full-on costume glory and whatever. How'd they get their powers? Shut up.
The film doesn't give a crap. We still haven't had an origin story for any of these three girls.
Yeah.
Again, no, just fuck it.
Fuck it and shut up. This film doesn't want to tell those stories. And then the movie ends, and there's a moment when it cuts to black, and you just expect it to jump right back to the beginning again in some fucking Groundhog Day nightmare. And somewhere, someone's going to cut this and loop it for 24 fucking hours and then cut it so that it loops again if necessary. If you just leave it on live on YouTube, it'll loop for days and days, the same fucking movie. And at the very end, she wakes up and realizes she had a premonition. And then we go about the same fucking movie. It's going to happen. If it doesn't, I'll do it. I'll steal the fucking thing.
Now, if she does this, we will put it out on our social media, and I highly recommend that you get a bunch of friends together to watch it. Make sure you have a hardcore Spider-Man nerd among them.
Oh, yeah.
And provide a whole lot of booze.
That was the thing that was missing, the booze. We forgot the fucking booze. I need a drink. Oh,
and
well,
Cineplex does offer booze now.
Yay. Way too expensive. Huzzah. This film is a clusterfuck.
When it cuts to credits, it's a Cranberries song that I'm pretty sure is only there because this movie thinks it's 2003 to such a degree that it's following the Tobey Maguire formula.
Yeah, and it feels very out of place. There's nothing more out of place than that song just suddenly starting up. And I think I actually shouted, really?
I'm pretty sure you did, yeah.
I'm not eager to ever revisit this film. I don't know if I ever will. But having seen it in theaters certainly was an experience. You know, like watching a car crash.
I on the other hand, I don't know. Actually, with my finances right now, I seriously doubt I'll have the opportunity. But if possible, I will happily go watch it for a fifth time. This is my new comfort movie. This film has a special place in my heart as one of the most entertaining disasters I have ever witnessed. I cannot describe how much I legitimately love this idiotic film.
So that's one fuck off and one, yeah, I'll watch it. It's a good balance. It balances out. It evens out.
Oh, yeah.
So join us next week for something that is far more of a controlled clusterfuck. That is Return to Oz.
No, seriously, this time we're actually doing Return to Oz.
We actually are going to do Return to Oz. And if we break that promise and do something else, or if you, for some reason, disagree or agree with us about Madam Web being a curious piece of shit, please contact us, and you can contact us at...
You can reach the show at realgeekshfx@gmail.com. Me specifically at themaritimelord@gmail.com, or you can find me at themaritimelord on Threads. Yes, I do still have Twitter and Instagram, but I've basically stopped checking Twitter, and frankly, I've developed an incredibly strong hatred for Instagram. Ironically, as I've delved further into a hobby with photography.
Yeah, that'll happen. I can be found still, unfortunately, on Twitter at Friday in Halifax and Crash and Burn, more happily, everywhere else. And now if you restart the podcast at this exact moment, you can relive the entire episode as if it was a premonition. Woo!
And as with the fact that this film is the greatest comedy of 2024, you should actually absolutely listen to this episode again.
But again, with booze this time. With booze.
Absolutely. The more booze, the better.
Goodbye.
See ya.